So last week, as we were leaving, Jeff Dorrell, one of the elders, stopped me and said, you're really taking them pretty deep. And I told him, I said, yeah, that's my point. I want to push and see just how deep we can go before people start leaving. But that was a joke. But in all reality, one of the things that I committed to when I entered into ministry was I realized when I went to seminary how much milk I was force-fed as a person growing up in the church, and I vowed to not always give people milk. I'm going to give you some steak and potatoes. And this series has definitely been one of those that's been tough to chew. I know a lot of people have asked a lot of questions, and there's been a lot of head-scratching, and that's exactly what I want to accomplish. I want you to think. I want you to dive really deep and explore the Bible from a different angle than you have, because I think when we do that, we get to the heart of who God is. So today is going to be no different. We are looking at one of the most well-known, retold stories of all time. And it's interesting. I can remember as a kid hearing about Noah and singing songs about Noah and having little flannelgrams where you stick two animals up going into to the ark. We have nurseries in homes that are decorated to the theme of Noah's ark, and we kind of sensationalize the story, but it really is, it's kind of a tragedy when you get down to what's really happening. And just like everything we've talked about up to this point, there's so many different translations and ways and interpretations when it comes to this account. And we're going to try to dissect some of that today. I just want to remind you of some statistics that I told you about last week. According to Skip Heitzig, who's a guy that I like to listen to and watch frequently, we don't agree on everything, but man, he goes deep and he does a great job explaining. He said these statistics: 270 nations and tribes have their own version of a flood story, a cataclysmic flood. 88% of these flood stories say that there was a favored family that was spared. 70% of those say that survival was by the means of a boat. 63% say that the flood was the result of man's wickedness. And many of those accounts speak about a rainbow. There are two accounts in the Mesopotamian area, ancient Mesopotamia around Canaan, that are very well known, Atrahasis and the Epic of Gilgamesh. And these are the two accounts that the Israelites would have encountered and would have known about once they left Egypt and entered into the Promised Land. And I think we have to keep that in mind as we look at the biblical account of a flood story, because understanding how our flood story interacts with those flood stories tells us some very important things about God. And eventually we're going to get to that, what I think we can take away from the flood story when it comes to who God is. But before we do that, I want to talk to you about these differing views. There's a lot of ways to approach this, different angles that the church world in itself takes, not just the secular world, but in the church, there's a lot of different ways that this story is taken. And one of the things that I run into as I start to do research about this, there's the arguments over the scientific, you know, reality. Can this happen scientifically? We argue about the historicity of it. Is it historically accurate? And I think when we take those arguments off the table, when we take the arguments of scientifically, is it possible? Is it historically accurate? I think there's some takeaways, you know, once we shed those things away that are very important to us as modern readers. So here's the views that are very prevalent. There's a universal or a global flood view. My argument, or my guess, would be if I took a poll of you all in the room today, the view that the strong majority of you would hold to is that this was a global universal flood, which means that the entire globe was covered in water and everything was exterminated except what was in the ark. And I would venture to guess that that's the view that most of you in this room hold. That's the view that you've heard from the time that you were a kid, and so you've stuck to it. If you're not familiar with that view, I'd encourage you to go down the road to Kentucky, just across the border, and the people at Answers in Genesis will give you all the information that you ever want to know about a global flood. because this is the view that they adamantly hold to. And in their mind, when you interact with anybody, they absolutely refuse that there's any other plausible view. But according to this view, the main purpose of the flood is to kill man and to flood the entire earth. The view states that animals are punished not because of their incapacities or their sin, but animals are punished because of the sin of man. So when we approach this view, this global flood, there's some assumptions that we have to make. We have to assume that rain is only one component of the flood. And there's some problems with this view, and I'm just going to be honest with you. I think the flood myself was at least extensive in nature, but the amount of water required to completely cover the entire globe, this is a problem that this issue has to try to tackle and explain how this happens. And then also not only the issue of water, but how do you get rid of that amount of water in 40 days? You know, those are the issues that this view, you know, has to try to find answers to. That's one view, global flood. The second view is an extensive flood view. Now, what's the difference? Well, the purpose is the same. The purpose was to kill all of humanity wherever it got to after creation. So there's the difference. The global view is the entire globe was covered. The extensive view says, well, the flood just covered the area that man had expanded to after creation. This view means that not all animals have to be killed. The problem with this view is, okay, if that's the case, why even take animals on the ark? And they try to answer that by saying, well, this is that we take the animals on the ark in this view because it kickstarts the resurgence of the animals. And so the local species need to be started all over again. That's the extensive view. Now, I'm going to stop right here and tell you the language, the Hebrew language in the Bible, supports a global or extensive flood view. The language that is used indicates a significant amount of land is covered with water. Some would argue that the word land just means like the land, local land, but in this text, the wording changes and it seems to indicate that it's either global or extensive. But there's also another view called the local flood view, and this is just that the flood only covered that geographic region. That it was a really significant flood, but it was only that geographic region that was affected. This is one view that's, you know, put up out there in the church world. Not many people hold to it that I've run across, but there are people that do argue from this perspective. And then there's this view, the parable view. So this is the fourth view. The parable view would say that this is not a historical event, but it's a story that's used to tell us something about life or about God. So when we think about the parable view, I want to challenge you. I don't hold to the parable view, but I want to at least get your minds turning a little bit. I can remember when I was a kid learning about George Washington as a young boy. In elementary school, you get to hear about George Washington, and one of a couple of the character traits that are really taught about George Washington are his honesty and his integrity. And the way that that was taught is you're told the story that when George Washington was a young boy, his father gave him a hatchet, and he took that hatchet and he went out and cut down a cherry tree. And when his father confronts him, George Washington's response is, I cannot tell a lie, I did cut it with my hatchet. And then the story goes that Washington's father embraced him and felt that his son's honesty was worth more than 1,000 cherry trees. You know, this is a story that we're told from the time we're young to teach us about honesty. Well, it turns out that the story is a myth. If you go to mountvernon.org, you can read all about it. Here's a quote from one of the articles that I read. This was from George Washington's first biographer. His name is Mason Locke Weems. Listen what they wrote. Ironically, this iconic story about the value of honesty was invented by one of Washington's first biographers. And this is what really is interesting. An itinerant minister, so the preacher's lying. an itinerant minister and bookseller named Mason Locke Weems. After Washington's death in 1799, people were anxious to learn about him, and Weems was ready to supply the demand. As he explained to a publisher in January 1800, Washington, you know, is gone. Millions are gaping to read something about him. My plan, I give his history sufficiently. I then go on to show that his unparalleled rise and elevation were due to his great virtues. Weems' biography, The Life of Washington, was first published in 1800, and it was an instant bestseller. However, the cherry tree myth did not appear until the book's fifth edition was published in 1806. Now, isn't that interesting that we're told a story about a little boy with a hatchet cutting down a cherry tree to demonstrate his honesty, but the story is fabricated? The fact that the story is made up doesn't mean that Washington wasn't a real person. It doesn't mean that he wasn't a person of value to our society. It doesn't mean that he wasn't honest. It just means that the story was told for a point. And when we think about the parable view of the flood, this is very similar. It's a story that was told to teach us a point. So whether we fall on the, you know, this is a historically accurate account, to the other end of the spectrum of this is a parable, there's things that we can learn. There's things that are important. Here's why I say this. When we take our story, the flood story, and I've told you it's extensive. I told you we're going to cover, it's not very big. It's bigger up there. It looks better. The rest of chapter 6, we started chapter 6 last week, the rest of chapter 6 all the way into chapter 9, you get this phenomenal story, and it's one giant chiasm. And we've talked about this before, for those of you that have been here. A chiasm just means that there's bookends, there's a middle, and then it works its way into the middle and back out in reverse order. And what you see if you follow this giant chiasm is that it's constructed beautifully. And one of the reasons it's constructed in such a way is because it's very important. It's an important story. And if it's very important, we want to remember how to tell it accurately. And one of the ways that we remember how to tell a story accurately is we structure it in such a way that we can do so. And this is one of the ways that these ancient writers would write or speak. It was a device that helped them memorize how to tell the story with accuracy, with intent. So if you can see up there, you can see how we start with Noah, we end with Noah. Right in the middle is God remembers Noah, but it walks itself in and then it reverses itself back out in the same order. Why would Moses go to such trouble to be so structural in his writing? Well, because his point, I think, is to interact, and I've said this from the beginning. In Genesis, the whole point of Genesis is to interact with these other creation accounts, these other stories that are floating around in this geographic region. We've talked about Gilgamesh. We've talked about Atrahasis. There's other stories out there that talk about a flood that these Israelite people would have encountered. They would have known these stories. They would have heard these stories in Canaan when they went there. And so as my professor, Dan Dyke, says, he says, we shouldn't be concerned about the similarities. We shouldn't be alarmed that our flood story sounds similar to other flood stories. That shouldn't alarm us. That's okay. What we need to pay attention to is where they're different. Because in the differences, that's where we learn something about our God. So let's do a quick comparison and contrast here. The cause. According to the Bible, the cause of the flood is the evil of humanity. Humanity had become evil and had corrupted all of creation. See, it wasn't just a human problem. The human problem of sin had affected the entirety of creation. Creation itself was suffering because of the corruption and evil of man, according to the Bible. In these Mesopotamian stories, Atrahasis and the Epic of Gilgamesh, the cause for the flood is the simple fact that the gods are annoyed with humanity. Nowhere in the text does it specifically say that men are evil. We're just annoying. In fact, in one of the accounts, it says that humans are just too noisy for one of the gods to sleep. So the god becomes angry because he can't get enough sleep, and he decides he's going to flood the earth and kill humanity. And so the difference we see is a logical difference. When we come to this story, I think what we see is Moses is telling us an accurate story of what really happened in this flood. And he's saying the cause is not the fact that our God is capricious or our God is just ignorant. The cause is us humans. We messed things up. And then we look at the character Noah himself, and there's some differences, the Noah character. Because there's a Noah character in these other flood stories. In the other flood stories, the Noah character is not favored by the gods or God. In one of the stories, the way that this Noah character finds out about the flood is because there's a lot of gods in this story, and there's some bickering back and forth between the gods. They just can't get along like children. And when one of the gods finds out that the god that can't sleep is planning on flooding the whole earth, he has some beef with him, so he says, I'm going to spoil his plan, and I'm going to go tell one of these humans how to survive the flood. And so that's what happens. One of these gods goes and talks to a wall, and the Noah character overhears the god speaking, and he knows that he has to build a boat to survive the flood. In these other Mesopotamian stories, the Noah character becomes a hero. He's the point of the story when you read them, not the gods. The human is the point. And the human, the Noah figure, reaches immortality because of his ability to survive a flood. Now, when you get to our story in the Bible, Noah is spoken of as righteous and complete. We saw that last week. He was different. He was set apart than the rest of humanity. But when you read the full story of Noah, what you find is that Noah wasn't any different than any other people because his story ends in a negative light. So Noah's not put on this pedestal. Noah is not this, as much as we would like to make this the point of our stories when we tell our kids, Noah is not the hero of the story. He's part of the tragedy. And that's where our story differs. Our figure, Noah, he looks good at first and then he falls short. The focus of the story in the Bible is on God, his work, his delivering of creation. And there's one more difference I want to hit on real quick. And some of you are going to be like, this, what, whatever. But when you read the full story in the Bible, you get to the end and Noah comes out of the boat and the first thing he does is he makes a sacrifice. He sacrifices, and the text specifically says that God smelled the aroma and it was pleasing. Now, the details are important because in the other versions of the story in Mesopotamia, after the human survives a flood, the first thing he does is make a sacrifice, builds an altar, sacrifices. But in their stories, the gods are needy. They can't supply for themselves. They're not self-sufficient. They need to eat. They're hungry. So the humans make the sacrifice, and the gods come down in the form of birds and start to eat the sacrifice to fulfill their hunger. Now, if you read carefully in the Old Testament, you'll find there's another account when a sacrifice is made and the birds are driven away from the sacrifice once it's made. The point being that our God doesn't need us to eat. Our God doesn't need to eat. Our God is sufficient on his own. And so these things are important to keep in mind as we process what's really happening in this flood account. Now, here's where I go with this. This is my focus. My focus isn't really on, is it parable? Is it extensive? Is it global? My focus is on, how did the original readers hear this? What did it mean to them? How did they digest this story? And I think what's really going on here, I'm going to invite you to turn to Genesis with me. We're going to pick out some text. Pick out just a few texts. Most of you are familiar with the story. You know, God comes down, tells Noah there's going to be a flood, build a boat. Tells him to take two of every kind. I asked my girls last night how many of each animal did Moses take on the ark. I got a variety of answers. Barbara was the only one that got it right. She said none. Moses didn't build the ark, Noah did. So we get here to this account, and I want to start here at Genesis chapter 7, verse 11. In the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day all the springs of the great deep burst forth, and the floodgates of heaven were open, and rain fell on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. Now, what in the world is going on here? And when we talked about creation, we talked about this idea that when we read the account of creation, our mind automatically goes to a globe. As we know, the earth is a globe, a sphere. Modern science tells us that. Ancient readers, that wasn't the case. This is ancient cosmology at its best. They can't see this on Facebook, but if you're interested, you can find it on thebibleproject.com. They do a great job illustrating this, and I want to give them credit because I didn't come up with this. This is ancient cosmology. This is creation. When the ancient reader read this text, this is what they saw. They did not see a sphere. They saw a massive land that was floating or anchored by some pillars into a sea. And when they talk about the vault of the sky, they actually thought it was a dome that held back waters, because all of creation was surrounded by chaotic waters. And the work of creation was God creating a space for humanity to live on land, protecting them from the chaotic waters above and from the chaotic waters below. So what you'll see is right there in the middle, you have land, and then under that is Sheol, and then under that is the great deep abyss, and then you see the vault in pink, and then above that is the great deep abyss above. And so when we get here to Genesis chapter 7, verse 11, what do we find in the ancient cosmologic mind is the fact that not only is it raining from above, the floodgates have been opened and water is just pouring down, but it says waters from the great deep. And so scientifically, what may have happened is that these geysers just exploded from under the land, and not only was the land filling from above with water, it was filling from below. But what the picture is decreation. That's the picture that these ancient readers had in their mind. It is decreation. It is God undoing everything in creation that he had done. And when we get to this story, what this story is, it's a story about a great reset. It's a story about a new creation with a new Adam type of figure. And so here we have this water that's filling the entire world as we know it. Then you go to Genesis 8, chapter 15, verses 15 through 17. This is after the floodwaters recede. And God said to Noah, "Come out of the ark, you and your family, your wife, your sons, and their wives. Bring out every kind of living creature that is with you." Now notice the language here is very similar to Genesis 1 and 2. The birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground. Creation language. "So that they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number on it." Creation language. Again, the creation mandate. Be fruitful and multiply. All these things, from the things that creep to the things that fly, and everything in between, that's what's going on. It's the same thing that's used in the creation account. Then you get to Genesis 9:1. "Then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them," now this is the mandate to humanity in the garden, the same thing that God said to Adam and Eve, "Be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth." It's a reboot. It's a start over. It's a redo. God has undone everything and then redoing it now again. Now go to Genesis 9, chapters 20, or verses 20 through 23. And notice where the story ends. Remember where we end with Adam and Eve?
get to Genesis 3 and you're in the garden and you experience the fall. Look where Noah's at. Verse 20, Noah, a man of the soil, same description as Adam, proceeded to plant a vineyard. He's in the garden. Noah's in the garden, just like Adam. And when he drank some of its wine, he became drunk and lay uncovered inside his tent. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw his father naked and told his two brothers outside. But Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it across their shoulders. Then they walked in backward and covered their father's naked body. Their faces were turned the other way so that they would not see their father naked. When Noah woke up from his wine and found out what his youngest son had done, he said to him, and then he gives a curse. And where we end the story of Noah is naked and ashamed. Remember we talked about Adam and Eve? Naked and ashamed. And so what's happening with the story is that we see this pattern of humanity. That God restarts, we mess it up. God restarts, we mess it up. And here's the issue, because the question that we've been wrestling with, God promised that there would be a seed, that when the serpent struck his heel, that seed would crush the serpent's head. And so we get these stories put up over and over, like, here he is, remember? Abel. Nope, Cain killed him. And then we get to Seth, and it's like, oh, his name means to set something in place, but Seth's not it. Now we get to Noah. Everybody's evil, but Noah found favor. Here he is. This is the one. This is the seed. And then you get to the end of his story. Nope, he's naked and ashamed too. He falls short. And so we're left with the question when we get to the end of chapter 9, where is he? Who is it? We're still waiting. In chapter 10, you get all of this genealogy. And the genealogy is leading to a point when we're going to get to that in chapter 12, which we're not going to do. We're going to finish at 11. And what you begin to see is that there's these people, we have hope, our hope's dashed. There's these people, we have hope, our hope's dashed. And eventually we get to the point where we can get to Jesus, who traces his lineage all the way back to Noah. And he's the only one we get to where our hope is not dashed. Now, the interesting thing about Jesus is the way his story ends is not naked and ashamed. It's naked and glorified. Isn't that interesting? So what does this mean for us? What's the takeaway from this ancient story? What does it mean for our modern times? Well, I want to take you to the words of Jesus. If that's where it's leading, let's find out what he says. Because Jesus says something about Noah. In Matthew chapter 24, and I think this is where it really cut me to the heart when I was preparing for this. You know, because we look at the story and we say, oh, evil. The every thought and inclination of the human heart was always evil continually, is what Genesis 6 says. And I look at that and I can argue and say, well, you know what? There might be some evil in me, but not always, not continually. I'm not always evil all the time. And so I'm good. I'm not like one of those. And then I get to what Jesus says in Matthew, and it's disturbing. Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. And this is when Jesus is getting some questions about the end times. What's it going to look like? When's it going to be? You know, what's going to happen? And Jesus says this, but about that day or hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven nor the Son of Man, but only the Father. Now listen to what he says about the flood. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Now we know in Genesis the problem with humanity was the fact that they were evil. The little thoughts, the big thoughts, they were evil, and everything in between. But look what Jesus points out. Jesus doesn't point out the evil. He says, for in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage up to the day Noah entered the ark, and they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. This is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. And so when we read Jesus' words, he gives us a little bit more insight. Because humanity had two issues. They were evil. They sat around and thought about what they could do that was evil. And then Jesus points out that they were indifferent to God. They were indifferent. They were captivated by everyday life. They were doing the grind, waking up in the morning and doing what was expected that day, eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, over and over and over. And it was a perpetual cycle of just doing the same thing every day with little regard or little thought to the creator of the universe. And this is what set Noah apart. Remember, Noah was a man that walked with God. That's what the text says, which means he wasn't consumed with everyday life. Which means that he actually woke up in the morning thinking about, okay, God, what do I need to do today for you? How can I please you? What are you saying to me today? You know, I think we could argue that God may have tried to speak to many different people other than Noah. And maybe what set Noah apart was the fact that he heard the voice of God. He heard the warning. He wasn't caught up in just the rat race of life. So when we come to this text, the application that we see, not just from that story in Genesis, but from Jesus' words, do we fall into that category of people that are just captivated by doing life day in and day out with little thought or regard to what God has going on? Is God trying to speak to us the same way that he spoke
to Noah? Now I want you to go to 1 Peter.
I've been getting in trouble a little bit for going over time by the family. Not nobody in the church, just by the family. Really long today, so I'm going to shorten it up. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 19 through 22. Now, this is an interesting text, too, and we're not going to tease this one out very much. This is Peter writing about Jesus. He said, after being made alive, this is after the death on the cross, he went and made proclamation to the imprisoned spirits, to those who were disobedient long ago when God waited patiently in the days of Noah while the ark was being built. In it, only a few people, eight in all, were saved through water. And this water symbolizes baptism that now saves you also. Not the removal of dirt from the body, but the pledge of a clear conscience towards God. It saves you by the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at God's right hand, with angels, authorities, and powers in submission to him. Now, this is fascinating to me because this is what Peter says. Peter says that the water, that great flood, is both what brings judgment on evil and cleansing to the righteous at the same time. The same thing. The same flood, the same water, is judgment on evil, cleansing to the righteous. And he said that Noah and his family was saved through the water. Now, what does that tell me? That gives me a picture of who God really is. It gives me a picture of God's justice and his grace working perfectly together. Because these people all experienced the same flood, the same storm, the same gushing water up from above. Noah was spared, his family, they were spared, the evil people died. And it's the same event, and the same event brings both judgment and grace. And furthermore, Peter links this to Jesus. He links this to the work of Jesus, his death and resurrection. And that's what's so interesting about this story. When we get from Genesis 1 and we read all the way through all 66 books written over the course of thousands of years, over 1,000 years, many different authors telling one single unified story, it's leading to one person, it's leading to Jesus. And it's the same exact experience of the flood. Because in the cross of Jesus Christ, the same event we can experience both the wrath of God and the grace of God. And it's all how you approach it. You know, when you get to Hebrews and you read about Noah, we know that he was a faithful person. He's in the hall of faith in Hebrews. It was by faith that he built a boat. And because of that faith, he was spared. He heard the voice of God. And the story for us today, the thing that we need to take away from this is that Jesus is the ark. He is the ark that God has prepared. And it's in his death, that event, that cataclysmic event, that if we aren't in the ark, we won't experience grace, we experience justice. It's the same. Our lives are lives that are lived out just like the flood. And so we come to the story and we need to ask ourselves, do we hear God's voice? Or are we caught up in the rat race of life? Let's pray. Father, thank you for choosing to reveal yourself to us, for telling us who you are, how you work, how you act, all about your character. And what I find fascinating is that you don't just tell us about yourself, you tell us about us, you tell us about humanity as a whole and the tendencies that we have. But even in our shortcomings and our downfalls, you show grace and mercy. Father, I ask that you forgive me because there are definitely times in my life when I just get caught up in life, period. And it's the same old thing, the same routine over and over and over, like a broken record. Father, grant me the capacity to slow down, to listen to you. Thank you for fulfilling your promise to send us someone that would overcome evil and temptation. Thank you for opening the door of the ark of Jesus to all of us. Father, my prayer this morning is that if there's anyone here that hasn't heard your voice, or maybe hasn't listened to your voice, that they would step into new life through your Son, Jesus Christ, and experience your grace rather than wrath. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.